Good morning. Nice to see you all here on a beautiful summer day. Some of us this morning are in Sesshin traditional retreat. We've been sitting together since Friday evening, and it's just starting to get good. And then today at 4 it'll be over. I'm not sure how that happens. But what I'm talking about this weekend during our session is the a very short verse called Opening the Sutra. Opening the Sutra is traditional verse usually chanted in Soto Zen monasteries and temples before a Dharma talk. And this is an old verse. It's an old tradition. The version, the four-line version that we use goes back to the Tang dynasty in China, which is one of the golden ages of Zen. This morning is a golden age of Zen. Don't think it happened already and you missed it. It ain't happening tomorrow. but it goes back to the Tang dynasty and an empress named Wu Xian. And actually the roots of this go back even farther. They go all the way back to the Pali Canon. And there are lots of different translations of Opening the Sutra. But the version we have here at MZMC we've been using for quite a while, at least a dozen years, I think. And we now only use this chant in our traditional retreat setting. We only use it in Sesshin, but we used to use it before all the Dharma talks, even on Sundays, like this. So some of you I know will remember it. It's printed on the front of your program this morning, that top four-line verse. So I thought it might be nice to start this morning, just so you get a sense of what it sounds like, to chant it together. So if you don't have a program, you can look on with your neighbor or just listen and fake it. So let's chant this together. So rare to touch a deep and subtle Dharma, having it to see and hear, remember and become. We vow to taste the truth that is right here, and yet so far beyond words. Thank you. That was just lovely. So I talked about the first couple lines yesterday, but I know most of you were not here, so I'm going to kind of just do a quick review, which gives those of us who are in Sesshin a so rare opportunity to hear me say it again. My first memory of this version, I first came to Zen Center a long, long time ago, and we used a different translation. My first memory of this version was on a Sunday, just like this, but it was during December, during Rohatsu, our longest Sesshin of the year, and it was 2006, and I was coming back to MZMC after having been away for quite a while, and Tim, my teacher here, was giving the talk that day, and it was my first, actually it was my first time seeing and hearing him. And so we rang the bell, and everybody stood back then, and he came in and did three bhavas, and then sat down here, where I am sitting today, and we chanted this together. And because it had been a long time since I'd been to Zen Center, and because I hadn't seen the new guy yet, I thought, well, this is exciting. He's going to give a deep and subtle Dharma talk. And it says right here. So I was really, all right, I'm ready. Give me the deep and subtle. And he did. He gave a deep and subtle Dharma talk. It was lovely. Lovely enough so I'm still here 10 years later. But, you know, after spending some more time with this and hearing some of my friends talk about this verse, I misunderstood it. They put no pressure on Tim whatsoever to give a deep and subtle Dharma talk. It put pressure on me to hear it. It says, we vow to taste the truth that's right here, but far beyond words. So even if his Dharma talk had been a Hindenburg, I couldn't have blamed him for not giving me the deep and subtle Dharma. I could have only gone, oh, I wonder why I didn't hear it. Isn't that interesting? It's kind of a switcheroo, right? It kind of takes the person sitting in this seat off the hook, and it kind of puts you on the hook. So I like it. Well, I like it when I'm sitting here. So I also think it's neat we all chant it. The speaker chants it too. We all make the same vow. So this is the relationship that Buddhism, generally speaking, has with Dharma, with Buddha, with Sangha. It's the onus is on us. The responsibility is on us. Our liberation project is ours. It really is ours. It's one of the things that's unique about Buddhism. One of the things I actually like about it a lot, when I first started studying it, I was like, so Buddha doesn't take care of it for me? I was sort of bummed, but sort of energized by that. He doesn't do anything for me at all. Nobody does, but I get to. So that's the good news and the bad news, is that it's your job to get free. I don't know if you see that as good news or bad news this morning, but it's kind of both. So in Zen, for us, this sutra that we open is Zazen. That's the sutra. That's the sutra. The sutra is Zazen. There really isn't anything beyond that. So we trace the origin of Zen back to Bodhidharma, an Indian monk, a monk from India who is said to have carried the Zen tradition east to China, to China. And his teacher, Bodhidharma's teacher, Prajnatara, who would have also been in India, offered us a four-line poem. It's one of my all-time favorite Zen poems. I just love it. And it goes like this. He says, when I inhale, I don't dwell upon things. When I exhale, I don't pursue thoughts. Thus, I breathe the sutra as it isness, hundreds of thousands of millions of times. When I inhale, I don't dwell upon things. When I exhale, I don't pursue thoughts. Thus, I breathe the sutra as it isness, hundreds of thousands of millions of times. So he's saying, the sutra is breath. I breathe the sutra. The sutra is as it isness. How your life is actually showing up right now, exactly as it is. That's the sutra. That's the sutra. This is why Zazen is our entry gate. In Zazen, as you know, we let go of what isn't this. We just come back to this. We stop preparing for an imagined future, stop rehearsing an imagined past. We just return our hearts, our minds, over and over to as it isness. This is how it is. These are the sounds. These are the sights. These are the feelings. So it's very, very intimate. It's very intimate. It's very immediate. And this is kind of the pinnacle of Zen. The pinnacle of Zen, as it isness. As it isness. Not ideas about how it might be. Not memories of how it was. As it isness. He breathes the sutra. We all breathe the sutra. As it isness. So what I like about that, and the reason it gives me a warm feeling, is because I realize that my normal way of understanding sutra is that it's a scripture, right? It's a verse, something like the Heart Sutra, for example. Oh, the Heart Sutra, wow, central to Zen, really, really important. A lot of teachings in there, really deep and subtle. I want to memorize it. I chant it every day. I do. I chant it every day, and I have memorized it. Yes, really helpful for me, actually tremendously helpful for me. But there are times when the Heart Sutra, and I feel distant from it. I'm stuck in traffic. I'm stressed out. Where's the Heart Sutra right now? Nowhere. until I remember, oh, maybe I would, right? But what's never distanced from me, even if I forget, even if my mind is crazy, is my breath. What's never distanced from me ever is things as they actually are. Right? So he's breathing the sutra as it isness. That's all any of us have ever done, actually. Right? Even when we're caught by, ah, how I wish it was, that is how it is. I'm spending this moment as it is, wishing it were different. There it is. It's showing up. So that's why I say it's the pinnacle of Zen. Zazen is really our truest teacher, our deepest teacher, our most reliable teacher. Zazen, Zazen, Zazen. That's why we emphasize it so much. And I talked a little bit yesterday about how I see Zazen and its central position of importance in our practice as love. I see it as love because it's non-separateness. It's a practice of non-separateness. When I separate myself from moment, I let go of that and I come back to moment. When I separate myself from my experience, I let go of that and I come back to. And I offered the idea yesterday, that's all love is, actually. Non-separate. That's really all it is, non-separate. Doesn't love push you past your preferences? Love hurts sometimes, certainly. Feels good other times. It pushes us past our preferences. It isn't just the good stuff. It's non-separateness. And it occurred to me, when I'm telling somebody, I love you, it was just my way of saying, you're not separate from me. I feel that you're not separate from me. That's actually what that meant to me. You might drive me crazy, but it does not in any way prevent me from loving you and from including you. You're non-separate. That's how it felt to me. When I love somebody, their joy becomes my joy. Their pain becomes my pain. They're not separate. And, of course, we spend a huge amount of time as humans trying to separate ourselves. We love to separate ourselves from things we don't like. And we reinforce stories about how separate we are to try to stay safe, to try to try to further our kind of small-mind agenda. But Zazen's the opposite of that. It includes everything. So to me, it feels very loving. It really does. And, of course, the quality of our attention during Zazen is always kind. Unconditional positive regard we're cultivating for moment. Right? When your life shows up as this, you say, I see you. Hello. It's pretty easy to do when you're feeling really good and your body doesn't hurt and you're surrounded by people who are groovy. Pretty easy. Much, much harder to do when as it isness shows up as pain in your left knee because you've been sitting like crazy for the past 3 days. Little frustrations. Concerned about your wife, you're anxious about your da-da-da, it's harder to say, hello, anxiety, I see you, you're included. Hello, fear, I see you, you're included. That's when love becomes a little more challenging for us. But that's what it is. Just opening up to this, saying yes to it. And leaving behind that self that doesn't know. I don't know what this next moment's going to be, but I can say yes to it and leave behind that self that doesn't know. So then there's nothing to say. So the function of this verse that we have today, the function of this little chant, is to help prepare ourselves. We remind ourselves what we're about to do. We're about to open a sutra. We're about to read a sutra. We're about to hear a talk. We're about to be exposed to teaching. And so this helps kind of prepare our hearts for that. And for those of us who are in Sesshin this weekend, we know we have chants for everything. Before we eat, we have a chant to help prepare us to understand eating as Dharma. We have a chant. Well, there's chants for all sorts of stuff in Sesshin. Chants in the service, chants before meals, chants before Dharma talks, chants after Dharma talks. All about reminding us, come back and see this as Dharma. Don't think this is mundane. Come back and see this as Dharma. Don't gloss over this. Don't miss it. So, as we prepare ourselves to open the sutra of as it isness, to open the sutra of breath, we do this little chant with these four lines. And because I like to pick things apart and I like to imagine that there are patterns there that aren't really there, because I'm human. That's what humans do. We find patterns. I found in this little four-line verse, each one of those lines I decided has its own theme, and I decided that the theme of the first line, so rare to touch, a deep and subtle dharma, the theme of that was gratitude and wonder. That's what I saw in it. You may see something else. Your dharma's as good as mine. But so rare to touch something deep and subtle. That felt like gratitude to me. Wow. And wonder. This is incredibly rare. And so we talked about how in Buddhist tradition, the idea of being born as a human is almost unfathomably rare. This opportunity of human life is precious beyond all possible measure. So really the understanding is you've been born as a human. You've got to go for it. Don't waste this. You're not a stone this time around. You're not a tree. You're not a deer. You're not a toilet brush. You're a human. Right? Pedal to the metal. Go for it. You have a real chance here. You have a real chance. So, wow, rare and precious. And I also realize, because, you know, we're all sitting together, most of us are born and raised here in the West, where our kind of common shared cosmology is we only go around once. Right? That seems to be our collective cultural understanding. So if that's your cultural understanding, it's even more rare and precious. You don't get multiple chances, you get one. So no matter how you, no matter which worldview you hold, being a human is rare and precious. And I offer to you the idea that you don't need to be told that. I think you know it. I think everybody knows, underneath their anxiety, underneath their depression, underneath their fear, underneath their day-to-day routine, underneath that constant sense of being pushed, some part of you knows, man, this is amazing, this is precious, and this is fleeting. Some part of us, I think, knows that. So our response, when we actually feel that, when we actually taste that experientially, is wonder, wow, and gratitude, wow. So that's what I think the first line is about. The second line, having it to see and hear, remember and become. This, to me, felt a little bit more like we have direction now. We have some action. We know that dharma is deep and subtle. We know human life is deep and subtle. We know it's rare and precious. And since we have this to see and hear, we're going to start moving into action. I have to remember this. I have to become this. There is something that I need to do about this. There is something I need to do about this. So those are the two lines I talked about yesterday, and I'll review just a couple things I said, and then I want to move on to something new. My favorite part of this was the so rare part, because, as I mentioned, regardless of our cosmology, we have a sense that to touch deep and subtle dharma is really, really rare. So to touch a teaching like the Buddha's is really, really rare. To even get the opportunity to sit into inside a Zen center and hear somebody talk to you, wow, it's really rare. But this is Zen. And Zen explodes stuff like rare and subtle dharma being limited to the Buddha, or being limited to words, or being limited to a building like this. And it tends to say stuff like, what's rare about this? How would this be rare? Show me a moment that isn't deep and subtle dharma. There's nothing rare about it. It's the most ordinary thing in the world. All you've ever done your entire life since the very first you took after you were born and the doctor spanked you was breathe the sutra as it is-ness. You've never been separate from deep and subtle dharma. You can't be separate from deep and subtle dharma. You might not notice it. You might not be paying attention. You may want to gloss it over. You might want to fast forward it. Deep and subtle dharma might be showing up as a traffic jam you don't want to be in, or an argument with your spouse you really would love to not be happening. But there it is. It's still deep and subtle dharma, right? It's just waiting for you to understand, hello, I'm over here doing this thing. We're never separate from it. It's not rare at all. So I like that our verse lies to us. It just starts by lying outright. This is really rare and precious. Uh-huh. I don't think so. And of course it is. It's both. That's what's so great about Zen. You can never argue with anybody because everybody's always right. Oh, dear. The other thing I mentioned yesterday, and I think this is actually really cool. Have you noticed all the sense words that are listed in this? You'd think, I'm about to give a Dharma talk, you're about to hear it, the whole thing would be about words, 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 words. It's not. It says to touch, to see, to hear, to remember. So now we have mind. And then we vow to taste. Those are senses. those are senses. Boy, that makes a lot of sense to those of us who've been hanging around a Zen center. Because it's always about, where's your body right now? Where's your breath right now? How do you feel? Where's your body right now? Where's your breath right now? How do you feel? I've got this really cool idea about don't care. Where's your body right now? Where's your breath right now? How do you feel? And I was telling a story on Tim yesterday because he wasn't around. He is around today, but I'll tell it anyway. I was telling the folks, I was really proud of myself during one of my first multi-day retreats, so this would have been at least 8 years ago, because I had a really good Zen question, like one of those that's going to peel the paint from the walls type Zen questions. I had spent all morning formulating it. It was about the nature of consciousness and the relationship between consciousness and sense objects and sense organs, so this is really deep and subtle, you guys. And I was waiting for the bell to ring, so he called me up, and I got up there and I said, so Tim, I notice that when my eyes are fixed here, I can still direct my consciousness elsewhere in the visual field. So what's the relationship between consciousness and the sense organ? And I was like, he's going to answer my question, which is going to be awesome, because he's a Zen master, right? But even more importantly, he's going to think I'm awesome. Because this is a deep and subtle question. He's going to be like, ooh, I like him. You're promoted. Here's your robe. Right? So a big ego agenda there. I really did. I had a big ego agenda. I had this really abstract, pew. Do you remember what you said, Tim?
No. I think you made this all up.
Maybe I have. And then he gave me $1,000. No, what he said was, as I remember it, I asked him my deep question, and he said, where's your breath right now? Man, that popped my balloon. I'm here to tell you. That really popped my balloon. So I went back down to the Zendo and was cranky about that. And I thought, well, geez, maybe he was just sidestepping. Maybe he didn't know the answer. I bet you that's it. I bet you I stumped him. years later, I realized, oh, that was a really good answer. That was a really good answer. Where's your breath right now? What's happening in your life right now? Where's your body? Where's your breath? How do you feel? It would have been much easier for him to respond with an open heart to, my back hurts, and I'm bored and kind of scared. That's a human experience, isn't it? And I don't want to oversimplify this. It isn't that it's not cool to ask questions about the nature of consciousness and the relationship between sense organs and sense objects. That's cool. The 16 dhatus. You can go really into that stuff, and it's great. It actually really can help us to get free. But what we don't want to do is spend all of our time in that realm and forget it's happening right here, in this body, in this breath now. And that's where we get free. That's really where we get free. So he just redirected me. He just took me back to the vehicle for my freedom. Where's your body? Where's your breath? How do you feel? How's the retreat going for you? Right? So it was beautiful. So all I'm saying here is keep your practice very carnal. Keep it carnal. Keep it embodied. Right? It's sensual. The Buddha taught this over and over and over. Where's your body? Where's your breath? Where's your body? Where's your breath? This isn't transcend, go elsewhere. It's here, 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 here. That's how we do the transcending. Here, 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 here. And in Zen, we do this all the time. Anybody who's read Fukan Zazengi, the instructions for Zazen by Dogen, it's posture, 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 posture. Oh, and by the way, there's one line about what to do with your mind, and that line doesn't make any sense. It's just body, body, body. Right? Body, body, body. So the cool thing about that is the Dharma is not distant. It's not intellectual. You don't have to be smart to get it. And that's why we use words like taste, see, smell, become. So today I'll talk for the rest of our time about these last two lines. These last two lines. And I'm going to start by reading a poem for you folks by Hogan Bays. Some of you, I'm assuming, know Hogan Bays. Jan Bays and Hogan Bays are abbots, co-abbots of the Great Vow Monastery in Oregon. Contemporary Soto Zen teachers. And Hogan wrote a beautiful poem called In This Passing Moment. I think this really actually ties in perfectly with what we're talking about today. He says, in this passing moment, karma ripens and all things come to be. I vow to choose what is. If there is cost, I choose to pay. If there is need, I choose to give. If there is pain, I choose to feel. If there is sorrow, I choose to grieve. When burning, I choose heat. When calm, I choose peace. When starving, I choose hunger. When happy, I choose joy. Whom I encounter, I choose to meet. What I shoulder, I choose to bear. When it is my death, I choose to die. And where this takes me, I choose to go. Being with what is, I respond to what is. This life is as real as a dream. The one who knows it cannot be found. And truth is not a thing. Therefore, I vow to choose this Dharma entrance gate. May all Buddhas and wise ones help me to live this vow. So, we know when we're starving, we're hungry. When we're happy, we're joyous. That whoever we encounter, we meet. We know those things. He's talking about something really smart here, though, isn't he? There's something subtle between meeting somebody and choosing to meet them. Don't you think? There's something wholehearted about the latter of those. There's a lot of people we meet in our life, and in that moment we're choosing to say no. I'm doing it. My body's going through the motions of doing it. My mouth is saying the words, hi. But in my heart, I'm pulling back. I don't want this. I'm not choosing this. And so my sense is, this moment is being inflicted on me. Right? It's being inflicted on me. I'm saying no, and it's showing up anyway. That's called suffering. We have suffering. I want this to be other than it is. Suffering, just like that. Wow, so what he's talking about is so simple and brilliant. When there's pain, I choose to feel. When there's sorrow, I choose to grieve. It's what's happening, and he's deciding to make it a choice. He's saying exactly the same thing Prajnatara was saying 1,500 years ago. He's saying exactly the same thing we all say wordlessly when we let go of our ideas about our life during Zazen, and we just return. We let go, and we return. In other words, we make this moment and how it's actually showing up a choice. Isn't that cool? I mean, we actually have that power. That's actually incredible agency over our experience of being alive. I'm now no longer distant from the universe that's inflicting this thing on me. I'm actively participating. Yep, I'm saying yes to this. Way beyond my preferences. This is back to a love thing, right? I'm not separate from meeting this person. I'm not separate from the grief. I'm not separate from the joy. I'm going to say yes to this and engage with it as wholeheartedly as I possibly can. Wow, it changes my experience. We start embracing what actually happens. We start cherishing what happens. And when we embrace what happens, in Zen we call that stability of mind. Stability of mind. Our spiritual security in Zen is our ability to be with what is. Our spiritual security in Zen is our ability to be with what is, which is really different than what I was taught as a kid. If somebody said, what would make you spiritually secure? I'd be, oh, well, I don't know, never suffering would be a good start. Probably living on a cloud. I was really into clouds when I was a kid. I really wanted to live on a cloud. I just thought, well, because of the heaven idea, you know. I was raised Catholic, so I thought, well, it's got to be up. It's certainly not down. So it's probably a cloud, and the type of cloud that would be thick enough you could walk on, you know, and not fall through. Wow, that's what it would be. That would be spiritual security, knowing nothing bad would ever happen to me, nothing bad would ever happen to anybody I love, nothing bad, right? And so when I was first exposed to this idea, I'm like, that doesn't make any choice. Your spiritual security is your ability to be with this without wanting it to be different. That's it. Wow. It took me a long time to feel that. All Zen is really saying is make a choice. Choose this. It's the only thing you can choose, actually. I mean, you can fight it all day long. You can be in traffic and fight traffic. Go for it. It'll make you really, really miserable. You can totally do that if you want. I'm personally an expert at that. If I could just will this away. But what I notice is that it never, ever, 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 ever works, and it always, 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 always makes me miserable. I'm not giving up, though. Zen encourages me to give up on that particular agenda. So I'm going to try to paraphrase a story I read in a book called Long Quiet Highway by Natalie Goldberg. She talked about being with the way I remember it. God knows how close I am. The way I remember it is she was with Katagiri Roshi down at Hokyoji in southeastern Minnesota years ago during the winter. And I forget what the nature of the interaction was. I have in my head that she was serving him during a meal. And it was really cold. They were practicing in a big army tent. Tim remembers these days. Practicing in an army tent down there. So winter in Minnesota in a tent. You all get it. This is cold. This is like industrial cold. Really, really cold. And he saw that she was fighting it. He saw that she was tense. He saw that she was cold. And he said to her, "Eat the cold." Which is weird, the way I remember the story is, number one, you would not speak in a setting like that. It's silent. So him saying that must have felt important to him, must have had some sense of urgency. And I didn't understand this story at all when I first read it. I was like, what is his deal? Like, what? That felt to me like an unhelpful thing to say. I'm getting it now. Eat the cold. Choose the cold. It's what's happening. So this came back to me recently because I was in Indonesia for a number of weeks. I don't remember now. 3.5 or something like that. They don't have time in Indonesia. If you've ever been, you'll just know time is merely a suggestion. So I was in there for an indeterminate amount of time. And it was, well, for me as a Minnesotan and somebody of Irish ancestry, unbelievably hot, nonstop, mercilessly, brutally. Between 85 and 90, 24/7, humidity between 85 and 90, 24/7. So I was just actively really, really, really hot, and I just watched myself fight it. I fought it and fought it and fought it and fought it. I want to rush to the room that might have air conditioning in it. I might want to make sure that I don't... And at some point, I remembered Katagiri's thing. I just remembered it. I don't know what made me... He goes, eat the heat. Eat it. Choose it. Here it is. Your life is showing up as being really hot. You're in Bali. That's what happens here. You're in Java. That's what happens here. You're hot. Choose it. And I'll be darned. He was right. He was right. It changed my experience. I didn't stop being hot. I was still hot. What I did stop doing, though, was spending energy on wishing it was otherwise. I get it. I'm hot. I'll give myself to this. This is what's happening. And then I could actually watch in my experience when I would pull away and go, oh, man, I just wish this was... So now I'm hot, plus I'm miserable because I'm spending a lot of energy wishing it was otherwise. And as soon as I would stop and go, why don't you just go back to being hot, sweetie? This is the thing you can't change. Just be hot. But be hot with every cell of your body. Be hot with your eyelashes and your toenails and your breath. Be hot with your thoughts and your emotions. Just be the heat. Right? Then there's not two separate things. Wow. That was really cool for me. So thank you, Katagiri Roshi, for that. So our line that says, we vow together to taste the truth. We need aspiration. We talk a lot in Zen about aspiration. We vow, we vow, we vow. That's very, very, it's actually central. In fact, the name of this temple, Ganshoji, Living in Vow. That's what we're inside right now. Living in Vow Temple. Vow is central. What I would say today, just because this is what struck me when I was reading it, is please vow, but please don't strive. Please don't let your vow have the flavor of discontent. Please don't let your aspiration have the flavor of discontent. Do you kind of get how that can happen? Like, I really aspire to be a better banjo player, right? So that must mean, on some level, I think I'm not a good enough banjo player now. So I'm aspiring to be better because then I will have arrived at a thing called being a good banjo player, which puts me right now in the position of being a not-so-hot banjo player. Right? And this is really subtle. And we have actually very, very, very few Buddhist vows related to banjo playing. I don't know why. It's a huge omission to me. It's a perfectly legitimate instrument. And again, I'm talking about this subtle sense that we seem to have universally of, you know, discontent with present self-evaluation that borders on self-criticism, that borders on self-cruelty. And aspiration and vow, if we're not careful, can actually have that. I vow to become a good Zen student. Whoops, missed it. Right? I vow to become, we want our lives to move in that direction, of course. But please don't do it at the expense of things as it is. So instead of saying vow today, I'm going to say, just maybe make space in your life for that possibility. Maybe just create space for it. I create the space for it. I want to allow the arising of Dharma to happen when it happens. And then I can sort of rest in that. If we create a space for something, I can actually rest in that. It's a little harder for me to rest in something that feels like I'm being propelled. And aspiration and vow don't have to have this propulsive sort of dimension, but I think sometimes we tend to add that. So we vow to taste the truth. So rest, we rest. As we know, Zazen is very, very passive. It's very, very receptive. But because we're fond of embracing opposites, Zazen's also very active. And I would encourage you to sit like the world's exploding. Because it is. Ever had that experience of looking around and going, oh my God, it's all on fire. It's all on fire. All of it's on fire. That's true, it is. It's on fire and a lot of suffering. Infinite. A lot of transformation. We want our attention, we want our practice to be a marriage of those two things. Very, very active and very, very receptive. It's this attentiveness and action married with relax, acceptance, peace. Right? We want to marry those things. It's contemplative action. It's active contemplation. That's what Zen really is. Of course, we have to have a response that's active, but we want to come up from a we want to have that action come from a place of stability and peace, and not from frantic anxiety or fear. So I think of it's like a hammock, right? It has to be tense and taut enough, your attention on the cushion, to hold you up off the ground. Otherwise, you're just laying on the grass, which is also, by the way, very good. But it's like a hammock. You want your hammock to be taut enough to hold you up off the ground, but not so tight, right? So the Buddha actually used the metaphor of a lute string. A lute string, not too tense, or it'll break. It'll be sharp or not so relaxed it doesn't make music. Same metaphor. I'm just thinking of hammocks these days and not lute strings because I'm in retreat and I probably want a hammock more than I want a lute string. So our vow, we're vowing, vowing, vowing to taste the truth. Part of tasting the truth for us in Zen is service. Vowing is service. Vowing is serving one another. When you're in a sesshin container, and I hope you have been fortunate enough in your life to experience sesshin, if you aren't or if you haven't, please do. It's elegant. It's beautiful. And in a sesshin container, everybody serves everybody else. Everybody serves everybody else. Sometimes very, very literally. I'm your server. I bring you food and I bow down before you and I offer it into your bowl and then I bow to you again and leave. This container is designed to give us all a chance to serve each other. Everybody serves everybody else. We're all servants. We're servants in Zen. We're servants. That's what we are. Not servile scraping. I'm talking about serving. You offer yourself. You offer your life. That's what you do. You serve what's in front of you. You honor what's in front of you. That's the only thing you can do. That's our practice. Wow. We get to serve. It feels good to do that. When it's coming from a place of choice, I'm choosing this. Coming from a place of recognizing the other and I are not separate. Wow. It's like the right hand helping the left. That feels beautiful. The Mumankan Gateless Gate Koan Collection, Case 45, says, Master Wutsu said, Shakyamuni and Maitreya are servants of another. Tell me, who is that other? So Shakyamuni is the Buddha, the historical Buddha. Maitreya is the next Buddha, the Buddha yet to come. They're both servants. They're both servants. Isn't that cool? You'd sort of think, well, they're obviously the ones we serve because, you know, they're Buddha and all that kind of stuff. They're super lofty and they probably live in that cloud place I want to go. And here he's saying, no, they're servants of another. Who's the other? To taste the truth is our vow, to taste the truth. So yesterday I gave my Dharma talk at about 10 o'clock and then we had lunch sometime around noon. And in the third bowl, you know, Orioki, when we eat in the traditional fashion, we use a three-bowl system of Orioki. In the third bowl, we had broccoli. Ben is our Tenzo, and Ben made broccoli. I don't see him. Is he here? Oh, there he is. Hey, Ben. He made broccoli. So this broccoli was fantastic, you guys. I'm chewing this broccoli, and I could taste the entire life of the broccoli, the roots and the rain and the earth and the sun. He's back there laughing at me. He put a lot in that bowl, you guys. It's a very small bowl, but here's the earth and the sun and the person who picked it and all of Ben and Ann's careful attention cutting this thing up, and I had Gamasio, and I was like, this is fantastic. I'm really glad that my Dharma talk happened before the broccoli, because I can't top this. This is the Dharma we've all been waiting for. Not my no, give us more of the broccoli. There's the truth we want to taste. Wow. Wow. So moments like that are immediate. They're immediate and they're non-dual. And that's the theme of our last line, the fourth line. Immediacy and non-duality. And you know, Zen spends a lot more time on this than anything else. So you've already heard a lot on these ideas. So I don't have too much more to add. But the immediacy of me chewing on broccoli, that is not my ideas of broccoli. It isn't my memories of other broccoli. It isn't my ideas about future broccoli. This is happening in my mouth right now. Wow. There is no separation. And then to go one step further with the no separation, non-dual idea, this thing that 30 seconds ago was called separate from me, broccoli, that somebody is bowing and offering me. Oh, it's separate from me, broccoli. There's a me and there's a broccoli. Oh, those are two things. Cool. Now I'm chewing on it. It's not quite so separate anymore. I could probably still choose to spit it out, but I didn't. I swallowed it. Now I can't find the separateness anymore. Now it's the cells of my body. Now it's the energy that I'm using to give you a talk. That is the way Dharma is. That is the way love is for us. We suffuse one another all the time. Do you feel that? How we get that? How we get it from the glass of water we drink? How we get it from the sunlight? We get it from the sound of the squirrels in the trees. We get it from the broccoli. We get it from the traffic jam. We get it from the loud motorcycle at the stop sign. These things go through us, you guys. They go absolutely through us. We love to think they're separate, but they're really not. The truth of Dharma is immediate. There's no mediator. There is no mediator. And we always inject one. I like the broccoli. You can hear me liking the broccoli, right? I like the broccoli. I choose the broccoli. I would prefer the broccoli to the da-da-da, right? I have a filter, too. Everybody has a filter. But the point is, Dharma is something that's encouraging us to go past that filter. The thing you like, the thing you don't, forget about that. Choose love. Love doesn't have those preferences. Like, dislike, no. This is something pushing us way past that. That's why Zazen's such good practice. I don't want to be bored. Guess what you are? Choose it. I'm really content right now. Good. Don't hang on to it. Choose it. Don't try to grasp it, objectify it, put it in your pocket and keep it. Now you've separated yourself from it again. Isn't that interesting? Oh, yeah, I want some more. Oh, I've just turned it into an object. I've actually just separated myself from the thing I want. That becomes not love. That becomes possession. So, Zen Master EQ, a lot of you know that name, EQ. If you don't, do a little research on EQ. He's one of the more colorful characters in our pantheon of Zen teachers. Not recommended for kids, probably. Really. Anyway, he wrote his own four-line poem that I think is the very same thing we're talking about here today. Sick of what it is called, sick of the names, I dedicate every pore to what's here. Sick of what it's called, sick of the names, I dedicate every pore to what's here. That's really good. That's the very same thing Prajnatara said. The sutra as it is, the sutra as it is, very same thing. So we vow to taste the truth that's right here, and yet it's beyond words. Sick of the names, sick of the words, sick of what it's called, we dedicate our pores, our practice, ourselves, our breath, to what this is, to what's here, what it really is. And beyond words, folks, includes words. Words are fine. They're not an enemy. Words are great. But words also go beyond words, right? And actually, I think words are really good at going beyond words. Because beyond words is certainly chanting the Heart Sutra. Whatever just got transmitted to you, whatever you felt there, is beyond words. That long talk you had with your friend, your really good friend, you had a long talk with him. Isn't that beyond words? You had a lot of words, but isn't what actually happened there something beyond the words that you exchanged? Have you ever read a transcript of something and gone, this is just dead? I mean, the words are here, but on the page it's just dead. It doesn't tell me anything about the experience. Have you ever read like the script from a play going, God, that play made me cry. And now I'm reading on the page and going, boring. It's because what happened was beyond the words. It included the words, but it went beyond them. The Har Sutra is this way. The conversation with your friend is this way. The poems are this way. Even our silence is this way. So, of course, you can find beyond words. And you can't not find it. It is your life. Your life is not separate from Buddha. Your life is not separate from Dharma. And certainly you're in community with every other being, so it's sure not separate from Sangha. So, of course, you can find it. You can't not find it. You don't need to work too hard. That's also why we don't need to try to squeeze anything out of our practice. We just don't need to try to do that. We do not have to try to make zazen about something else. We do not have to turn it into a gaining idea. We do not have to have it turn into a washcloth that we want to wring and twist and force. We don't need to. We can let it be exactly what it is. We don't have to use it to get to something else. And so in Soto Zen, it's why we don't make any requests of it. We ask nothing of zazen. Nothing. We just show up and do it, and bell rings, we're done. We ask nothing of it. We really don't. At least we're not supposed to. I know we all secretly do. I know at the end of sittings we kind of go, B+. Tomorrow maybe A-. That's my aspiration. B+, not good enough. Sure we do that. That's part of the game. But I encourage you, to the extent you're able, don't make any requests of it. Because our practice is an offering. It's not a request. It's an offering. It's an offering. I'm here to give this. I'm not here to get. I'm here to give. What am I giving? Me. That's it. Me. My wholehearted participation in this moment, in this breath, in this sutra called As It Is, that's all there is. I'm offering every cell, every pore to this. I don't have anything else to give. So I'm not asking anything. I'm just making a choice. Like Hogan said, I'm making a choice. I'm choosing this. I'm choosing this. Then it's an offering. And you can kind of feel the difference there, right? Then every sitting is satisfactory. It's all satisfying. It meets my need to give. And if what I gave today was a hurting heart and an achy leg and busy thoughts, okay. The universe has no problem. Well, it's glad to be there with it, right? If I'm trying to get something, now I'm going to evaluate. But if I'm trying to give, I just do it wholeheartedly. So that's my invitation to you. It's the same thing we always say when we're sitting in this cushion. Practice, please. It matters more than you know. Practice with wholeheartedness. Give yourself completely to what's happening in your life right now. Because it is the whole of your life. It is the whole of your life, what's happening. The entirety. So giving yourself to it is your way of not wasting it. Do not waste this precious life. Don't miss it. Thank you very much. I'm grateful to you all for your attention and your kind presence today. And you know, because we're in retreat, I don't think we'll do questions today, actually. I'm happy to turn it over to Raymond Ardoin, and we'll just do announcements.